My life. Amazing. My life.
My life.
Amazing.
My life.
My life.
With
amazing.
My life.
Amazing strangers.
Hello and welcome to episode 5 of My Life with Amazing Strangers. I'm Gary Robinson. Now, in this episode, we continue our journey through the world of care in the UK with a focus today on prisons, prisoners and prison officers. My guests are Andy Briley and Kevin Neary. Andy and Kevin are two of several prison-experienced individuals who've written The Good Prison Officer, which was published back in 2023. The authors, all now professionals, practitioners and educators in the criminal justice field, explore good and bad examples of professional practice, drawing on themes such as discretion, respect and relationships within prison culture. Now, bear in mind, this conversation was recorded shortly after the publication of The Good Prison Officer back in May 2023. However, I've got to say, the content, discussion and the debate of the conversation is as fresh and as relevant as it was when we recorded the chat. Now, I personally and professionally found this interview absolutely relevant to care, not only for those incarcerated, but also for those working in prisons up and down the country. Now, Andy starts the podcast explaining to me about his role as editor of the book.
I was the editor, Gary, yeah. Well, we said when I recruited, if that's the right term, the core contributors to the book, we set out a criteria, and the criteria was that I needed them to be in professional roles in and around the criminal justice system. I needed to, of course, have been in prison, because the book is titled The Good Prison Officer, Inside Perspective. So the notion was that there were going to be people that have had lived experience of being in prison, because who better to be able to guide prison officers about how to be good prison officers than people that have received both good and bad practice. And then what I wanted is additional experiences of intersectional disadvantages. So what I mean by that is I needed the contributing authors to have either been in the care system, to have been in the been in recovery from substances, to have been excluded from school, and to have experienced youth incarceration. So you might ask why those additional disadvantages. Well, because when we think about people that write about the penal system or the carceral space in prison, it's usually academics that come from privileged bases. Some of them have actually been to custody. And there are other people that come out and that have been privileged before going to custody and then come out and use that platform to write about their custodial experience. So to get the voices of the people that I was trying to reach into the literature, I really wanted to set the kind of criteria that mean that I would get voices that are often not heard in the literature. And the reason why I came across that is because having had my experience of going through prison, etc., and then working in the youth justice system for 15 years, which was quite odd. When I went on to teach in the higher education system, the one thing I noticed straight away is that there was a gap of what I would say authentic prison voices in the literature. So it is researched by people that have been to prison, but people talking about prison and prison practice the way it resonated with me was completely missing. So the idea of the book is that we filled that gap, Gary.
And Kevin, if I could come to you, and we'll continue to talk about the book in just a moment. What was your involvement, Kevin? But actually, before you give me your involvement, give me a little bit about your background and why Andy contacted you to take part in contributing to the book.
My background was, as Andy says, similar. We all got similar. All the authors have got similar backgrounds. What Andy spoke about being, you know, being expelled from school, not completing school, not getting qualifications, ending up in the system, in the criminal justice, ended up in incarceration, in prison, going on through that journey in life where we then move on, we recover through that lifestyle. We then go into the professional field, and through that professional field, and the key from my own personal experience was about the importance of relationships, which is one of the key kind of themes that comes out in the book. But personally for me, it was the relationships that got me to where I am today. And through the relationships and through social media, that's where I met Andy. And we had a lot in common, you know. So it was just through these connections that we kind of communicated with each other. And then, you know, and Andy, you know, asked me whether I wanted to be involved in the project. And I was like, well, of course, because that experience, because I always talk about the good and bad and everything, you know what I mean? And you know, and I had very unpleasant experiences in the system in prisons. And also, and there was elements of good. And it was about looking at that good practice and that good understanding. And I could see where I could contribute to that.
Andy, the purpose of the book, and you've outlined it beautifully in my first question, but the outline of the book is it's aimed at improving what goes on in prisons. It's aimed at prison officers. It's aimed at practitioners. The aim of the book is quite far-reaching, I imagine.
The funny thing is, we got a guy called Shad Maruna, who's like a leading scholar around assistance literature and penology in the academic world. He sets it out in the foreword in saying that what makes this book unprecedented is that it is unprecedented. We're 2023, and prisoners coming out of prison and writing about both their good and bad experience of prison is unprecedented. So that screams to me of an issue of inequality. What that says to me is that there are people's voices that have been heard in and around the criminal justice space due to their privileges and their experiences, and there are people that have had the experiences that are missing from having that voice in the policy arena and the practice arena. And I think that, you know, as society's evolving and developing and moving in the right direction, I think that that's changing. And I think that that's, I hold optimism in that space, because what it means is that if we are caring for any group in society, and I mean any group, so you could cut this across. If, you know, we sat here as free white males talking about how lovely we are to females, we might start to create our own narrative. So we have to include that voice. And I think that that's the essence of this book, is to help prison officers. And by the way, it was a bit of a shock to me, because when we set out, we didn't know what the kind of conclusions to the book were going to be. It might have been because of the type of people I were recruiting and the jobs that they're in now. But the kind of essence of the book, the flavour of the book, is to teach prison officers that first and foremost, we care about them. And in the recommendations, what we found through the research, particularly me, is that we're not taking care of prison officers. And if we're not taking care of prison officers, we can't really expect them to have positive outcomes for prisoners. And you know what, Gary? I didn't expect that. Do you know, when we set out to do this project, that's not something that was in my mind. But actually, that's what the literature says. That's what I've experienced teaching prison officers. The HMPPS and the politicians in particular are not taking care of prison officers. And I think that that's a generative process. So if you don't take care of those that are caring for others, then that will get in the way of the care that's being provided. So what the book is, a lot of the recommendations around the book is, let's take care of prison officers. And actually, those of us that have had the experiences of going through a prison actually care about what you're doing. And I think that's a message of hope in the book, and I'm hoping that that came out.
In what way do we not take care of prison officers then? I imagine you're talking about society as a whole or certain sections of society. What aren't we doing to protect and care for prison officers?
If we compare prison officers with social workers, or in my job, I was a youth justice officer for 15 years. The pay is just not commensurate. They're undervalued in terms of pay. Then we've got to think about the shift work that they have to do. Then we have to think about what Kevin will outline in a minute in terms of the complexities of the role of the prison officer. And they've got to be up to date in self-harm, race relations. You know, they've got to know how to de-escalate violence. I think somehow, somewhere along the lines, we've come to the conclusion that doing an assessment, a plan, an intervention, and regulating that through bureaucratic processes is more value to society than someone that actually does the doing. Because we can't be well as human beings without what Kevin outlined as connected, authentic relationships somewhere along the line. And it probably doesn't just apply to prison officers. It probably applies to nurses and other roles too. Certainly the education sector. So if you think about like staff that are doing the kind of hard role of working in alternative provisions and stuff like that. So I don't think it's just prison officers, but we focused on that at the minute. So there's a whole host of different reasons. They're under the retention rate for staff in prison officers at the moment is through the roof. They're really, really struggling to recruit staff and then to retain them when they're getting through the door.
There's lack of training. You know what I mean? There's lack of support. There's lack of help. There's lack of awareness. There's a lack of awareness. So it's the mindset of people going into taking the job. Is it going to be a prison officer? And a part I talk about is like, you know, well, it's job security. I get a salary and I've got this and that, because maybe that's the reason why they're going into the job, but they don't get the complexity of who they're actually dealing with. And so you've got people who have been in the care system as children, who have been traumatised through the years, who then progress into the young offenders, then into the adult prisons. And the level of mental health can be, and not just the mental health, but the behaviour, the condition, belief, the anger, how they're dealing with anger. And these prison officers are not trained to understand what that is, what is happening to a person when they're aggressive, when they're angry, when they're needy, especially when they're very needy. We also forget as well, and this is the residents, for instance, when you're in prison, that you don't consider that officer has a family and is a normal human being and has got a life to lead, who has the same issues and problems like everybody else, and stresses and strains. And then you come into an environment, you know, you can feel an energy in a hall. Do you know what I mean? And then when the people serving you are taking care of you, are under pressure, it becomes more pressure again. So that's where the no care comes in. Do you know? And I heard somebody say this, and this is not me saying it, I just heard somebody saying it, which made so much sense, is, you know, a lot of former guys who left their communities to go and join the army. They were running away from stuff in society, and then they joined the army, and then when they come out the army, they go and join the prison service with untreated their own traumas. Do you know what I mean? And they've got their own aggressions, and what can they handle and what can they cope with? And that really made sense to me, because the levels of aggression that can come from staff, where's that behaviour coming from? Is it something past them that they never got to see? What was it like in the military for them? But then even the prison setting, even the police setting, is all military-based. It's all military-based. It's not care-based. It's all control-based. It's all about, and it's that. And prison officers don't get that training where they can understand and look, as we talk about, Gary, we've spoken about this before, Gary, where we look beyond that behaviour. Where's that behaviour coming from? How can we look deep at that? How can we help rehabilitate that? And there's just not enough prison officers trained properly, not clinically supervised and supported and helped, because, again, that needs funded, that needs, you know what I mean? So there's all that, and there's a lot of complexity within in the system. And then within that, you've got these handful of prison officers who have seemed to have a natural ability to make a connection with a human being. And I talk about the handful of prison officers who I met on my journey. I was very fortunate to meet, who showed that kindness and care and compassion and treated me like a human being, where others I met who just didn't have time or day for you, because they weren't coming for your caring capacity. They were coming for a place where you were just a number. You're just a number. This is what you do, and this is what we're going to do with you. Not just me, but countless others as well. So that's that side of it that I've witnessed and saw and still see it, I mean, in levels of the day.
If you're using words, and indeed if you're demonstrating your care and compassion and thoughtfulness in that environment, is that not seen as soft, as something where if you are seen as too caring, or if you are too compassionate, or you're taking an interest in somebody, then, you know, if you are a prison officer, can that be seen as a prison officer, you could be taken advantage of, or you're too soft, or you're a pushover? I'm using very basic language here, but does, you know, because when I think of, if I'm thinking of a prison, I'm thinking of, you know, a big burly prison officer who's there to keep order, as many, many people probably in the country do. But we're talking about a completely different concept. But does that not leave the prison officer open to abuse and goodness knows what else? If they're deemed too soft.
I wouldn't say it's soft, whereas it's lack of prison officers, right? So lack of. So when you've got two prison officers on the landing looking after 75 individuals, right? For instance, I'm just flinging numbers about, but yeah, so it's not like there's a load of prison officers, and they're probably not doing their best, but they're under a lot of pressure because there's not a lot of needy guys doing sentences who are wanting to do stuff. What I found is it was the officers who were actually delivering courses in the prisons were the prison officers who were the ones who could show that kind care and compassion side. In the hall, it was a different kind of setting, because the pressure's put on the staff, because they've got, you know, it's like one prison officer per 50 prisoners sort of thing, you know what I mean? I think it's a number like that. And when you're in the hall, you only see a couple of prison officers, and then everybody's pressing their buzzers for different things, people with different issues. Two people, not even four people, have got the capacity to deal with that mentally. You know, so their frustration, these guys' frustrations can come out. As I say, there's a lot of mental health, and there's a lot of people who are struggling inside, and, you know, their liberty's been taken away from them. People can be like losing parents, or kids are unwell at home, and they're in prison, and there's a lot of stress on them, and they may be heavily demanding, and yet you've only got a couple of prison officers on a wing. And the only time you'll see more than two or three prison officers on a wing, Gary, right, is that a fight breaks out, or an officer gets attacked, or there's a fight starts, and then next minute they're on. So they only come in to deal with that. Do you know what I mean? But I think if they did more, More openness in prisons for rehabilitation and more communication, and then they leave it to two. But that's the structure of the system, of the prison system. That's not any reflection on the prison officer itself. You're just putting too many people under pressure.
Andy, what do we do to change society's perception? Because there is an element in society that goes, well, tough, you're in prison for a reason, and they don't see the reason behind behaviour. So they won't necessarily think of adverse childhood experiences. They won't necessarily think about history. They won't necessarily think about mental health. What can we do to change society's view and society's opinion of how prisons are run, and consequently how, and I know you're not a fan of the word, but rehabilitation then happens?
It's not that I'm not a fan of the word. Okay. So I'm gonna probably say something. It might seem at odds with the context of the conversation that we're having, but if we keep using the term rehabilitation for people who go to prison in a culture that research came out last week about prison officers, right? The prison officers are experiencing trauma in the prison context. Right. So the research shows that prison officers face higher levels of mental health issues than in other sectors. Right. OK. So when I read that stuff, the obvious question to me is, how are we as a society set up something that traumatizes people that work there, but rehabilitates people that have to live there? You can't have your cake and eat it. Right. So if the term rehabilitation, in my view, it sanitizes the reality of a prison, and it tells society that people go there to get treated. Now, we need an honest conversation about this, right? Because so it's not like I don't like the word rehabilitation. In how it's being applied, of course, I'm all for helping people have better outcomes when they leave prison. But I'm almost arriving at a position where I said, you know what? Why don't we just start saying it's not rehabilitative and it's punishment? Because that's what society wants to hear. And we're almost fueling that by saying, and I beg the question, who's actually benefiting from this concept of rehabilitation in the criminal justice system? But go back a bit when I started talking about how inequality manifests in society, right? If you set up the notion of rehabilitation now, what I look at when I look around at all these private and trusts and charity organisations and the criminal justice itself, they're all purporting to have these effective evidence-based outcomes. So let me run through some statistics with you. 46% of adult prisoners leave prison and reoffend within the year. For children under the age of 18, it goes up to 70%. The question for me is it beneficial for the people that are going through the prison system and having these harsh realities to keep telling the public that we're rehabilitating them? And I think it's misleading. So I'm left in this place where I don't want to just start using the word punishment and not using the word rehabilitation. But I must admit that with prison officers being identified as experiencing trauma, the reoffending rates are high and have been stubbornly high. And that's according to Dominic Raab, not me. And we incarcerate more people per head of capita in the UK than anywhere else in Europe. Something's not working. And so I'm not quite sure rehabilitation captures all that context that I've just outlined. So it's not that I'm against the word per se. I just don't see that in the statistics and the research that it's actually the right word to use for the current prison system in England and Wales and Scotland.
Is the court system, Kevin, crucial in this? So when somebody is arrested, they're in custody, they're then taken to court, does there have to be that understanding of the individual and their background and what they've been through to try and avoid prison, as it were, to try and reduce those people going into prison, reduce those numbers? Have the courts got a role to play in this?
Yeah, great question, Gary. But so what I do recognise, I can only speak for the East Coast of Scotland in a sense. I'm not saying every judge and sheriff, just I know personally some judges and sheriffs do and fiscals recognise that they look, and there's a lot in Scotland now about, like for instance, Pullman Young Offenders Institution. There's absolutely, I think there's like two people in Pullman Young Offenders Institution under the age of 18 locked up. and, you know, and then it's 18 up to 21. And then what they're looking at, courts are looking at trying to find like the disposals away from prisons, so there is a lot of movement going on with that. I don't know where about the rest of Scotland. I can only speak for where, the field that I work, the part of Scotland that I work in. So they are recognising that, you know, we know prisons don't work. We know they don't work. I mean, part of my work I do today is to keep people away from prisons. I have great communications with fiscals, but it's down to government. You know, Lady Doran is the second highest judge in the land, in Scotland, and she also sentenced me, and I got to meet her. And I spoke to her about, you know, sentencing and sentencing young people and, you know, and it's crimes and does it work and all that. And what she said to me was, don't come barking at my door, she says. Go and speak to the government. I only follow government guidelines and government things through sentencing. And you know, she's explained it. She was just explaining to me as she is as a High Court judge. And I suppose that's the same for everybody. But what we have now is we don't have as many people getting held in custody, young people being held in custody. They've got a thing new in Scotland that some law being passed through that any young person under age 18 can be sent to prison now. But what they're doing is they're then sending them into secure units, right? Which again is becomes another topic. But as Andy's saying there, the rehabilitation, we keep shouting about it, or we need rehabilitated, but it's not there. It is not there. You may finally have a place of safety. You may be in a place of safety in prison and you're getting a bit of a structure, but when you come back outside, that one out of two will offend again because they come back into society without the proper help, without the proper support, without the proper care, and that's the part. But how do we, when they say, oh, how can you rehabilitate somebody who's never had a chance in life, who's never shown how you love normally, when that's been chaos all their life? How can you rehabilitate a person like that because they've never had a chance, they don't know how to? So it's about a lot outside of that which led them into that.
I think we've got to sometimes. Defining and contextualising words is important, right? So rehabilitation, I want you to just take a moment here. Rehabilitation actually comes from the medical world, right? So if I break my leg because it's fully functional, then it goes in a plaster and they rehabilitate it. That's the process. But if we think about the adult prison population, so we know 42% of them were excluded from school permanently, right? So that's one in two people were excluded from school. That's an indication that childhood wasn't quite right, right? My daughter's not going to get excluded from school. So it's a bit of an indication that things aren't quite right. So 25%, so one in every four doors you knock on in the prison estate for adults, will have spent time in the care system. So that's a large number. It's one in four. It's huge. The literacy expectancy of the people that are in prisons is like primary school level for the majority. So the problem again with the term is you're not bringing people back to a state that they once were. Because if you do that, you're taking them back to a position which led them in the trajectory of going into prison in the first place. And then it's how the term is batted around. So for example, like I teach prison officers and they're very well-intended individuals, right? So I can give you a number of examples, one of them being they set up on a drug rehabilitation unit. They got a toaster and you know, they really pushed and advocated for this kitchen space, you know, for prisoners. And they then used the term, and I was listening in their space, I didn't challenge it because sometimes I'm the person in the room who will stick my hand up all the time and say, can we really think about that? You know, the problem's going to lie with me. So I roll with some of this stuff a lot. But they were saying, you know, we've got rehabilitation back into the wing. Now, there's a difference between being kind, caring for people and getting a toaster and a kettle on a wing. But the word is just overused and a really complex term is used in really simplistic ways. Because where's any evidence to suggest that putting toasters on a landing is going to help somebody not reoffend when they leave custody? So although well-intended, I think it probably goes back to Kevin's, but well, is it? These guys are on a master's degree. So in terms of being trained, they're at a high level, but I don't know whether we're really making really complex issues. We're trying to make them really simple. And I think that the point that Kevin made is I think if we start using the word like build, not re-anything, not re-entry, not rehabilitation, I think if we use the word build, once people have been punished, they've gone to prison, they've been punished. Now, let's build their lives when they get released. Maybe, just maybe, that'll go back to the question that you asked, Gary, about public perceptions. Because once they've been punished, the term is punishment. I didn't experience a rehabilitated prison system. I experienced a punishing prison system. So when I came out, I then had to build a life because I was in care. My mum was in care. So I never had any family support that could help me post-prison. But I've managed to do that, and I've managed to build myself a life. But I never rebuilt it. I had to build it from scratch. So I think those terminologies we use around prison are really important.
You make so, do you know what? I did not expect this conversation to go this way at all when we started. And it's fascinating because we've talked really more about the role of the prison officer and how we need to care for them as opposed to, well, we are touching on prisoners. I'm really intrigued by overcomplicating on both sides, whether you're a prison officer or you're a prisoner. Is it about being human? And that's a very simplistic term. But if we treat each other with a bit more humanity and a bit more understanding, as we do, well, we like to think we do outside of the prison walls, is that what we're aiming for here? Is that the key?
When we say human, what level we're talking about? It's just being the human. When human beings are in stressful situations, they respond to stress, right? They will respond to stress. So frustration, you know, you're at the airport, everybody's in the queue, the plane's cancelled, and people get frustrated and angry and upset. It's just human. It's a physiological response to stress and stuff like that. So when you've got in prisons, when you've got somebody who's frustrated in a prison cell, and you've got a staff member who's also frustrated because of what's ever going on in person's life, or the stress he's under because of the amount of work they've got today and then dealing with it, then that can blow up. Or you, do you know what I mean? So it's not being human. That is human. That's all human behaviour. It's all human behaviour. But, you know, in the prison setting, what is that? And I'm not saying it's always chaos like that in prisons, but I think the point being is how do we prevent people from even going into prison in the first place? And to, as Andy says, how do we build them? If they do get into prison, how do we build them when they come out, to give them that support network, to give them that capacity to build relationships and to build self-esteem and self-worth and you know, and to look at, you know, their issues. But then how do we even prevent them going to prison in the first place? Because a lot, like myself, my life just went on pause, came out of prison. I talk about being, I was informed, I felt rehabilitated to a point, right? And I can say that to the day I walked out of the prison, right? But the rehabilitation tools left, and I relapsed back into the behaviour, back into the substance use, and then I died through the process. So, but on the human aspect of things is what we're talking about, you know, whether, you know, we're all humans, but we're all conditioned, we're way of life and how we're brought up, and that sort of can cause clash.
That's a great answer. I love that answer, actually. And I suppose when I'm talking about human, if I qualify that, I'm talking about how we like to believe we treat each other with respect, building relationships with care, with love. We don't always get it right. We don't always do it. We try not to carry prejudices with us, but we do. And I suppose that's what I mean, I suppose, Kevin, about the word human. So maybe the word human was the wrong one actually to use, but that's what I was getting at, if that makes more sense, if that clarifies that.
For me, in my chapter, so I kind of use the same model. So I worked in youth justice for 15 years. My PhD at the moment that I'm studying is to look at what is the relational dynamic of people that have been through the system that then become part of statutory services like I did. Because I would argue, I think it's probably common sense that when a kid's coming out of custody and I say to the kid, I've been in the care system and I've come out of custody four times, something happens in that relational dynamic. But that's not really helpful for me not to be able to, you know, and I make people laugh when I sometimes do talks and I say to them, well, it's no good me telling you go take some heroin, steal a car, get locked up for a couple of years, come out, you better work with kids. Because that's just not helpful. So what I did in my chapter is I looked at some kind of key principles that I could share with colleagues across the criminal justice system that I used from having that lived experience of being on this side of the fence to then working on this side of the fence. And it just follows four key words that could be abbreviated by PACT. So presence, because what in my time of being a professional, all people come well-intended, more often than not. You probably get 1 or 2% that just couldn't give a backside and probably just get in track to get paid. But generally speaking, most people, I believe, come well-intended. But you've got to be able to think, what's that person in front of me seeing when they see me as a probation officer, as a prison officer, as a social worker? It's really important. And that's the power of showing up, and we kind of put that together as presence. And then once you've understood what that person sees, how do you then physically adjust yourself emotionally and physically to become what that person needs in that moment in time? And that's attuning to the person that's in front of you. So presence, attunement, And funnily enough, in the criminal justice system, as I've worked 15 years, I would hear the word engagement all the time, Gary, right? So some staff would come in and they'd say, right, I've gone out to meet this 15-year-old kid. They're not engaging. What that means really is that you've got the power, you've directed them, and for whatever reason, they've chose to not comply. So I don't like the word, because like you just said, Gary, human, right? Most relationships, in fact, if not all, if they're going to be constructive, they're going to be reciprocal. So I would like to change people using the word engagement to connecting. Because if you change it now, that practitioner comes and says, I've just gone out and met this 15-year-old boy and we're not connecting. Just in the shift in that word, you've meant that you're playing a role in that relational dynamic. And if you follow those key principles, PAC, you're more likely to develop trust with the people that you're working with. And I think that you know, that is my way that I've approached my work as a result of the experiences that I've had. It's not to say that that will work for everybody, because we're all different. But I think you need to work out a way of approaching your practice if you're going to be human and develop trusted relationships.
One thing that's coming out of the conversation is the importance of language. And it's something that's come through in other podcasts about other subjects as well, I have to say, and other interviews, that language is mega important in the way that we approach and changing minds and hearts, I suppose, as well. And connecting, I think, is a great word. And Kevin, it's a word that we're familiar with certainly with work that you do and work that I've done previously as an interviewer. So that connection is really important. And that's what it goes back to, the art. Is it an art of the art of relationships? Kevin, are relationships an art in the prison environment?
I wouldn't say it's, you know, would just be Andy's bringing up there. There's a connection, the power of connection, and you get a connection with people, and then people are like, you know, self seeking, but they're actually, they're seeking attention, attention seeking. You know, they're seeking, but they're looking for connection, they're connection seeking. Rather than self-seeking, they're looking for a connection, and that sometimes that's what's lacking in people's lives, you know, and you can get that. And if you've got a relationship, and that, by the way, and that, we're talking in a prison setting here, if it can happen, it happens in your working environment as well, and having that positive relationship. And then the work that I do today, the key is the relationship. The biggest barrier between me and young people today is trust, because they've never been able to trust anybody, because I've been let down with the system, let down with no parents, let down with that. And I think it comes natural to anybody who cares for another person, who wants to connect with them. Do you know what I mean? And then they can get that trust in you. And then when the trust is there, then you can both work together. And that's where they can then trust you on where, like, for instance, in the role that I do, is to get them trust the services or the professionals to build and connect a new relationship with them. We're all designed to connect as humans. We're all there to connect to humans. But then if, as young people, humans have been bad to you, it's quite difficult to connect. And that leads into a system where lack of trust and all that stuff plays a role in it, Gary, you know what I mean? So some people can come in. Majority of guys, for instance, if you look at like white-collar criminals, for instance, the white-collar criminals are, you know, people have not really been hard, the fraudsters and all that, for instance, they get sent to prison for all this fraud stuff, but they've actually had really good connection and relationships, and they become really good role models within prison estates, you know, because, and what's happening is that the people who need the support and that, having to hit that type of upbringing or that type of, and all the stuff Andy just spoke about there, that's what was missing in their life. You know, so when you look at that, you can see how connection and relationship can work, because they've been shown how to have a relationship. They've been shown how they've had that connection. Do you know what I mean? So it's a kind of field day. You know, I don't think it's an expertise role to play in building a relationship.
It's a massive area that you've both described today. And in terms of, Andy, the work that then now needs to be done. So the book's out there. It's freely available. It was published in May of this year, The Good Prison Officer. What's next? What needs to be done next? So the book's there. I'm not saying is there a sequel or a follow-up, but what's the next part of your role, and what's the next part of Kevin's role to drive this to some sort of semi-conclusion? Because I think this is a long-term aim by the sound of things.
Yeah, well, there's been some significant impact. I work in the academic space, right? So there's motivation for academics to produce papers over and over again, because it stimulates finances, right? But for any academic, the objective should be impact. So David Abernethy, Okay. He's the governor of HMP Edinburgh, where we launched the book in Scotland, because we have two Scottish contributors. They've already made us aware that they want the good prison officer to be available for 700 prison officers that are trained per year in Scotland on their laptops. I mean, for me, with this just little idea in my brain about how we can use the voice of prisoners to really help and enhance the kind of operationalizing and practice of prison officers, that is just crazy. And we've had, for example, Jersey, the one contributing author was from Jersey. They're now putting her on the interview panels for prison officers. So it's had real impact. There is a question in there about why it's had less impact in England than the other places. But we'll, you know, I think it's a work in progress, because the chapters take on the micro, the chapters take on the kind of practical relational stuff of prison officers and building hope and aspiration, et cetera, and then the recommendations are more macro. So, I mean, it's only been out since May. I've had a number of different opportunities to go speak to different people in different spaces about the recommendations in the book. But the next step is hopefully for those recommendations to be picked up, because all that stuff that Kevin was talking about, I think the next step for that is the criminal. I can get into prisons, right, Gary, but I've got to go through a whole host of DBS check processes. Because when we're thinking about people that are despondent with services, for me, the natural gap there is to recruit people that can say, guys, come on, we'll take this journey with you and build that thread. So the criminal justice system, I think, has got to start reducing some of these barriers to let us back in the space, because we can assist the system. And that's at least two or three of the recommendations in that.
And Kevin, what's I mean, you do this every single day of your being. What do you think needs to happen next from your point of view and from your experience?
Do you know, I think that the proper training prison officers, and Andy just pointed out there what's happening in Scotland, and I think the reason that actually there's more of a drive in Scotland for it is because it's less populated than England. You know what I mean? There's less people you convince in Scotland, and we were already on a push anyway. And you know that potency, we talk about connection and relationships and that, which is sustained through the book, but we also have that with the people like David Abernethy, like our Justice Secretary Angela Constance, like various others. So when you've got, as Andy spoke about earlier, it's for the top down, you know, this is what we're pushing here, and it's sort of shown in Scotland that we have got people for the top hearing that, you know, taking it on board, supporting what we do, and it's that. And I just feel that there's more of a push on. I've been asked to go and do stuff at Addiewell Prison and stuff like that as well. They want to do stuff around about the book and that as well. Again, you know, but for me, I can talk from my side here and my experiences stuff, but you know, like, I need Andy's voice, because I've not got all the stats and understandings and views and all that Andy has. Do you know what I mean? I don't have that, which is important for what Scotland needs to hear. And suppose it's like getting to bring that into a full training package thing for, you know, for prison officers. I would like to see the good police officer book coming out in the future, the good teacher. You know, the good teacher, the good NHS worker, or whatever's capacity that may be, whether it be a doctor and that. Because as you talk about, everything is as good and bad in every job, in a sense, and there's a lot that in the good prison officer and in the recommendations, right, could come away from the prison system, you could put in the other system, social work, the good social worker. Do you know what I mean? You could go right across with that. So that's, I mean, where it's going to go, I don't know, because it is so early. Because it's only May, but I believe we've had a lot, well, for in Scotland anyway, there's been a lot of interest in that and people really excited about it as well, you know.
Andy, final word to you.
Yeah, just wanted to cover, actually, I missed that. Actually, I've been contacted by West Yorkshire. They're building, they've got finances for a trauma-informed West Yorkshire. So at the moment they're working with Leeds Prison, but it might expand to Wetherby and Wealdstone. So we're in a conversation, and that came about, they contacted me because of the good prison officer. So the potential is there to do some kind of trauma-informed practice training for prison officers in at least those three prisons. So you start off piloting something small, and hopefully it would grow. But I think that stuff is going to come. I think people need to start reading the book, and then when they find out what it actually is, I think it'll manifest into various different opportunities later down the line.
Andy Briley and Kevin Neary. Thanks, gentlemen.
My life. Amazing. My life.
My life.
Amazing.
My life.
My life.
With amazing.
My life.
Amazing.
Strangers.
In episode 6 of My Life with Amazing Strangers, I'm in conversation with David Wilson Wynn. Now, full disclosure here, David isn't exactly a stranger. I've known him for years. He's a great pal, and I'm absolutely delighted that he's coming on board as co-host, one of the co-hosts of this particular podcast in future episodes. David is highly experienced in care, working in many, many roles in the sector, and he's currently enjoying his role as Senior Dementia Consultant at the Dementia Services Development Centre within the University of Stirling in Scotland. And you can hear about David's 18 years of experience, that's so far, incidentally, within the field of health and social care. The conversation, well, it's passionate, it's fearless, and it is very, very honest. And if you want to work in care or you're thinking about a career in care, you really don't want to miss it. In the meantime, take care of yourself and others. Until our next episode of My Life with Amazing Strangers, goodbye.